This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. There are heroes in every hometown all across this great land, and we're going to talk to a very intriguing man today, all the way from Florida. You know, this is August 15th, 2009, the 64th anniversary of VJ Day, the day that the Japanese signed those surrender documents on the USS Missouri, the Mighty Mo, which you can still visit today. And normally I would have a guest relevant to VJ Day, but it's another anniversary this week. It's the 65th anniversary of the day that this week's guest was shot down in the skies over Europe. Erwin Stoveroff was in the news this week. I saw him on television, a national story about an organization that provides service dogs for veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. VetsHelpingHeroes.org. That's his website. Feel free to go there right now, and you'll get a little background as we get to the point where he's going to join the show. He's going to join us after our first break. There are a couple other things that I want to tell you about, but I'm very excited about that, having Erwin Stoveroff with us today. An incredible story from World War II, even more remarkable what he's up to today and how much he's been able to help the men and women serving our country and coming back from their time in the service today. I also need to tell you about what's coming up in a couple weeks. August 29th, you may have heard about KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson Conference Center in downtown Fresno. I'm excited. Not only am I hosting a seminar, a couple versions of the seminar on preserving family history, in which we'll talk about how to get your relatives to share some of the things that they've been through in their lives and some other elements to that, but I'm going to have some special guests that day. I'm going to be signing copies of my book on the Bulldog baseball team, Underdogs to Wonder Dogs, and all the proceeds from my book are going to go to the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. But I'm also going to be joined by some of the folks you've heard on this program who have written books, and they're going to be down there with me signing their books. Gus Zerniel is planning to be there. Dick Johansson, who's written a great book, A Passion for Stewardship, he'll be there with his book. Just a couple months back, you heard from Don Ball, who was a B-17 radio man and gunner with some incredible stories. His book, Follow the Bouncing Ball, will be on sale there. He'll be on hand to sign it. And Dr. Stan Lindquist, who has a terrific story, the letters that he wrote during World War II, published in a book called Letters from Private Buck. That book and Dr. Stan Lindquist will be there as well. So a lot of my good friends who have been on this show who've written books will be there signing books. I'll be signing books, and it's your chance to come out, find some good reading, support a great cause, and meet some of the people who you've heard over these airwaves. So that's August 29th at the Radisson Conference Center in downtown Fresno, KMJ's Lifestyle Expo. Okay, now back to today's show. We're going to take a short break and then come back with the man I just told you about, Erwin Stoveroff. In the commercial, if you're by your computer, go to VetsHelpingHeroes.org so you can learn about his organization. Erwin Stoveroff from Florida joining us momentarily here on Hometown Heroes. It's News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I hope you've checked out that website already, VetsHelpingHeroes.com. Remember, that's HEROES.com, VetsHelpingHeroes.com. I screwed that up. Let me start over because it's .org. Yeah, and I got it right when I recorded it before. That's why I recorded. Okay, here we go. Take two in three, two, one. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Paul Leffler with you here at News Talk 580 KMJ. Remember, we're online at kmjnow.com where you can find a link to the website we're going to talk a little bit about, VetsHelpingHeroes.org. That's VetsHelpingHeroes, H-E-R-O-E-S. .org. The man behind that website, the man you'll find smiling in the picture on that website next to a service dog, Erwin Stoveroff, joins me from Florida on the line. And I don't know where to start, Erwin, because your story is so remarkable, but maybe we should start with what you're up to now. Tell me about Vets Helping Heroes and how this program originated. What are you doing, and how much great work are you doing for the veterans coming back from overseas?
Well, thank you. I hope it is great, and I tell you what happened is I'm a national service officer at the hospital in Palm Beach, in Florida.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing that?
I've been doing that for 12 years now, and I decided that I wanted to do that when I retired. I'd worked for Thomasville Furniture Industries for about 40 years. I retired and decided that there was more to life than just playing golf, or I enjoyed tennis, and I found time for that. But I think it was more important that I do something for veterans, and particularly ex-POWs, who were not as lucky as I am and coming home and at this stage of life, feeling very, very good. I'm very fortunate. So that's what I decided to do. And about 3 years ago, at a director's meeting at the hospital in Palm Beach, I was advised of something that absolutely floored me. It was the fact that our government does not supply any funds or anything to help any of these young men who are blind and disabled. Yes, they do a complete rehab program for them, but when they're finished with their rehab program, they have to rely on private donors to get them a seeing eye or a service dog. When I found that out, I just said, I've got to do something. And they advised me at the VA, would I be interested in starting an organization and tying in with America's Vet Dogs Canine Program from Smithtown, New York? And I said, yes, I would. I got involved through the VA with the American Vet Dog Canine Program and told them what I had in mind was to raise funds, and they were very anxious for me to get started.
I bet.
Yeah, and very, very cooperative, and they are to today. I mean, we have a great relationship. They're a wonderful organization, and so I'm pleased that the funds I'm raising are for them. And I just recognized that something had to be done beyond what even they were doing, because these vets were waiting a long time.
Now, how much, since you started with the Vet Dog Program?
Pardon?
Since you got started with the Vet Dog Program,
yes.
How much money have you guys been able to raise for these veterans coming back?
We have raised $1,600,000 since we got started in the early part of 07.
Wow.
I was very fortunate, though. Nobody does anything alone. I was very fortunate. I started off alone for the first 3 months. And in that period, going to various organizations and individuals I knew, I raised about $100,000. Then I realized that I needed help, and I needed somebody who would be very good with me. And I had a neighbor by the name of Jerry Kramer, and he is very philanthropic, very successful, and a businessman, and very dynamic in fundraising. And I asked Jerry to join me. And he did, and through 08, Jerry and I were partners, and we did have a board. But at the end of 08, he decided that his partner needed help, and he was said, I don't want to raise any more money. I'm worn out. So he left me. And, you know, but hey, I said, hey, I started this, and I'm not going to stop, and we're going to go on. And we have gone on. And I have a board that is mainly military people. So we're covering it from every aspect.
And again, folks at home, if you want to donate, you can do that online. That website is vetshelpingheroes.org. Before we get to some of your story and why you felt compelled to do this, tell me a little bit, Irwin, if you can. I'm sure that one of the most rewarding things for you is to see what these dogs actually mean to the veterans when they get back. What's kind of the biggest thing that you've seen, or the most moving thing you've seen, as far as how much of an impact having that service dog has on a veteran coming home?
Well, the first dog that we got was for a young man who lost both his arms. His name is Eddie Wright. And I got to meet Eddie and got to know him. And it's a good question, because I asked the same thing. I said, Eddie, what is the most important thing this dog has meant for you since you got him? And he said, the most important thing is, when I'm walking down the street, people look at my dog, they don't look at me. And I thought, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. Mm. But how important it is to these young men, because, you know, they are handicapped, they are disabled, they have lost part of their limbs, or they've lost their eyes or their brains. And what a great remark that was, that, you know, people aren't staring at me anymore. That's just one example of what I've seen. I've been to Walter Reed several times in Washington, and I see these young men as they're learning and just starting to learn with new legs or new arms. And, you know, it's just, well, you got to start crying when you see this. It's so emotional. But when you talk to them and when you make them understand that you have an opportunity to give them something that they will have that is so important for them, for example, mobility, independence, and companionship, and an undying love. I talked to a young man by the name of Aaron down here in Palm Beach several months ago, and he was blind. He had been on three tours before they finally got him, and he said to me that he was unsure, that he knew that his wife and children were there waiting for him, and his mother would take care of him, and I had my dog. I have a dog that was reassigned to me. His name is Cash. And I had Cash with me at the hospital, and I had him pet him and listen to him, and I explained to him what that dog had meant to me. And I said to him, "Is one of the reasons why I'm doing this is I went through combat, but gosh, I'm lucky. You know, I came back in one piece. I didn't lose my eyes, my arms, my legs, nothing. I just had an experience. But here you are, and you've been through this, and what I'd like to do for you and what we want to do, not me, the Vet Dogs Canine Corps and my organization, Vets Helping Heroes, we want you to have, at no cost to you, a gift for life. And let me explain when I say a gift for life, because a dog, a service, professionally trained service dog, will work 24 hours a day for, let us say, 8 to 9, maybe 10 years at the most. Mm-hmm. And after that dog is going to be retired. And we will automatically, when the dog is retired, we will replace that dog with another dog for our heroes. I call them our heroes. And that's why we call this program A Gift for Life.
Well, and again, the organization is Vets Helping Heroes. It's at vetshelpingheroes.org. We're talking to Erwin Stoveroff, the president of that organization. I'm sure, listening to his voice, you won't believe what his actual age is, but you can tell that this fulfilling work is keeping him young. He has a pretty interesting story to tell as well. And with all the prisoners of war, the ex-prisoners of war that you've heard on this show, you've probably heard it said time and time again that their motto for the American ex-prisoners of war, we help those who cannot help themselves. That's what Erwin Stoveroff is doing now. But I want to find out a little bit, Erwin, and we will come back to your organization and how people listening today can help. I want to hear a little bit about your story during World War II. I've gotten some tidbits, and it's pretty remarkable. But let's start at the beginning. How did you end up as a bombardier in the U.S. Army Air Corps?
Well, number one, I volunteered. Mm-hmm. Number two, I wanted to fly. And number three, I guess I was as patriotic as every other guy that enlisted. It's something, I have to say it, our generation believed in it. I mean, there was no hesitation whatsoever. Even with a draft, there was no hesitation for wanting to be a part of it. You had to be. And so that's how I got involved. But I knew I wanted to be in, and it was then called the Air Corps, which is now the Air Force. And I went through my all exams and everything that was required, and I was all set to do my basic training in pilots. And they advised us, I'll never forget, I was down in San Antonio, Texas, at Kelly Field, and they said, "Gentlemen, we have pilots. We've got a real problem. We have a shortage of bombardiers and navigators, and that's what we're looking for, and that's what we'll hope that you will volunteer to do. And later on, if you want to become a pilot, we'll see about it. But right now, we don't have them, and we need them." So I became a bombardier.
All right. And the adventures were just about to begin. But right now, we need to catch our first commercial break. When we come back, we're going to hear about all 35 missions, or at least some highlights from those 35 missions that Erwin Stoveroff flew. We're going to find out how he became a prisoner of war, what he endured in that time, and how he's here talking to us today, because that in itself is pretty remarkable. Erwin Stoveroff from Florida, our guest today. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The whole idea behind that name, Hometown Heroes, is that you can find a hero in your hometown, no matter where you live in this great country. There are men and women around you who have put their lives on the line for the freedom that we enjoy, the freedom that gives us a chance to talk to you this afternoon. Erwin Stoveroff was one of more than 16 million Americans to serve during World War II. We've talked about that being a dying breed and how important it is to tell these stories now. He's even part of a more exclusive group, a smaller group, the ex-prisoners of war. And Erwin, I know with all your work with the VA hospital there, you're privy to some statistics about how many World War II prisoners of war remain. What's the latest number that you've heard?
Oh, the latest number is 17,000. That was out of 100 and about 130,000 altogether. There are 17,000 left.
Well, you guys are survivors. Forget those shows on TV. If you can survive time in a prisoner of war camp in Germany or Japan or anywhere else,
yeah,
you are certainly a survivor. And before we get to that, how you became a POW, as a B-17 bombardier serving with the 44th Bomb Group and the 506th Bomb Squad, you were in at a time where they'd gone past 25 missions would get you home. It was going to take 35 missions to get you back to the States. So I imagine when you took off with your crew for that 35th mission, there was probably a little bit of excitement or extra adrenaline in the airplane that day.
Oh, well, first place we started off, you're right, at 25, and then they raised it to 30. And then after 30, they said, you know, we'll never fly more than 35. And they were certainly right in my case. They said, because, you know, if we do get the crews in, we were still losing a lot of crews, you know. You will not have to go to the 35th mission. Well, we did. And the 35th mission, which was our last, really and truly was our last, because I got shot down. We were just over the channel on a short run. I could see the English Channel right out of my window, and we started our bomb run, and we were going to bomb and blowing up all the bridges to keep the Germans from escaping back into Germany. That was our target that day in the Falle Gap, and it was near the city of Caen, which
was
pretty well known.
Just about exactly 65 years ago, because that was August 13th,
right,
1944.
Exactly, exactly. It was exactly to this day. So what happened is there was several bursts of flak, and we got hit on our number one and number two engine, and the hydraulic system failed. Everything was failing. There was fire coming into the ship, so we had to bail out. I was in the nose of the plane, so I jumped through the nose wheel door, and fortunately, every one of us got out of the plane before it exploded.
Now, I've read a little bit of you telling this story, and you say the first thing that you did after you exited that airplane, well, obviously you had to pull your chute, but you threw something toward the ground. Tell us what that was and why you did that.
I got rid of my dog tags because I'm Jewish, and it had H on there. And, you know, in those days, I don't know what they're doing now, but you had to have an H, C, or a P on your dog tag. And so knowing where I was going, I decided the best thing I could do was get rid of my dog tags because they were shooting at me as I was coming down, so there was no way they would say I was a spy that they had picked up in the country. And I did land right in the German front lines, and I was captured. Well, they were shooting at me coming down. I was captured immediately and taken to a cemetery. And I looked around, and the German officer said, 9-9, we do not kill our prisoners. And so,
which I'm sure made you feel everything was just fine.
Oh yeah, it was a great feeling knowing they don't kill their prisoners, but you know, they kept us in a farmyard for a while. My co-pilot and I tried to escape. We got caught and told us if we ever did it again, that they would kill us. They would shoot us for trying to escape, which we were told we were supposed to do. So we tried it one time, and that was that. And after several days in the field, because we couldn't move because the our P-51s and P-38s were shooting up everything on the ground, they finally loaded us in trucks at night, and we ended up in Paris for a few days. And from Paris, I was taken to a Dulag Luft outside of Frankfurt, Germany, where all the air guys, anybody in the Air Force was taken there for interrogation.
And this place is infamous for the interrogations that took place there, and really, in some cases, what some people would call torture. I mean, these prisoners were not necessarily treated pristinely there at Dulag Luft.
Well, all I heard was the scare tactics. You know, they were, you'd hear the noise and the beating and all this stuff, and you think, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And I honestly, after my original capture and what I went through in the beginning, had anything happened to me except an unbelievable story while I was there. And may I tell the story?
Oh, I want to hear it. I know a little bit, but I want to hear all of it. And I think it has to do with the German officer interrogating you, right?
That is correct. I was in solitaire like the rest of us, and you were taken in and out and taken in and out. And my third or fourth time.
Now, before you get to that, did that shake you at all? When they have you in solitary, you're in a room where you can barely scratch your back, let alone think. Did it get to you at all?
Yeah, I wasn't very happy, I can assure you. I have to tell you, I think everybody else was, I think we were scared. I mean, we didn't know what to do, in particular being Jewish. You can't get that off your mind when you're in Hitler's territory. And actually what happened was that I think after my fourth interrogation, where it was name, rank, and serial number, because actually we didn't know much more than that, the officer opened up in perfect English and said to me, Lieutenant, you know, I know who you are, and I know what you are. And when he said that, I said, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
And that meant that he knew you were Jewish.
That's right. And so he started off by naming my mother, father, brother, sister, the grammar school I went to, the high school I went to, actually named a young lady that I had taken out when I was dating before the war. And I just sat there and I said, I just don't understand. I don't understand. And then he said to me, well, let me explain something to you. You lived on Claremont Avenue in Buffalo, New York, and my parents lived on Ashland Avenue in Buffalo, New York, and you were my parents' newspaper boy.
Holy moly.
And I said, that's about the same thing. I just couldn't believe it. And he said to me, I came here for a reason. I came to be with my grandparents because we are going to win the war. And that was his answer to me. But he said, I will help you. And what he did do, under religion, on my papers that I found and I still have, he put a question mark under religion. And so I was moved on and put in the boxcars and moved on to my permanent camp in Barth, Germany.
Now, I do have one question about that. My understanding, and I've seen several POWs show me those papers that you're talking about. You have an image of yours online. It was your file from Dulag Luft when you were interrogated. It has your mugshot and all that and all this information. Now, were you sure at the time that he wrote that question mark in there? Or
no.
Did you not find that out until after you were liberated?
After we got liberated, we went into the offices there, and they said, somebody said they found our files, and we all went and we all got our files. And I got mine, and down below it has a great big J-U-D-E when they segregated me in my prison camp.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get to that, too. Now, they took you to your prison camp, which was Stalag Luft 1. We've actually had several veterans on this show that were in that same POW camp in Barth on the Baltic. Sounds like a luxurious resort, but I don't think that's what it was for you. And I imagine traveling there on a 40 and 8 wasn't exactly a thrill ride either.
No, and you know what they did is, and I'm sure you've heard it before, what they did, they locked us in, and they did not mark the top of these boxcars at POW, which they were supposed to, and they would leave us in the marshalling yards at night because the British were bombing marshalling yards. And the Americans were shooting up everything during the day. So, you know, there were guys, I am, again, very fortunate. It did not happen to me. But there were guys that I knew that were caught in these boxcars, and some kids got killed. Call them some veterans got killed, and some of them were hurt because of the enemy, the fire from the British or the Americans, particularly the fighter pilots coming down, shooting up all the trains. But fortunately, it did not happen to me, and I did arrive in one piece at beautiful Barth on the Baltic.
What's going through your mind as you get to this prisoner of war camp? Obviously, you have guys around you who are going through the same thing, and I'm sure that helps. But to me, the uncertainty of it seems like it might be a little overwhelming.
Well, you're right, the uncertainty, but there was you had a sense of at least I made it to a prison camp, you know, because if the civilians got you, they would kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was fortunate. I dropped out in France, but in Germany, a lot of the guys dropped there, and they were pitchforked. They were hung. The German civilians were after them, and the Luftwaffe would try to get you, and at least get you to a prison camp. And it was a relief to to walk into the camp, and there you are. There's already 1,000 guys or more in the camp, and it's a sense of relief, but a sense of uncertainty, and uncertainty later on in February when I got segregated.
Well, and up to that point, I'm trying to do the math here, from August of 44 until April or May of 45, this is several months that you were a prisoner of war. I imagine that it started to take a toll on you physically as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, and you probably have heard it before, and I tell it just the way it is. We were one of the lucky camps that was getting Red Cross parcels, because if we relied on the Germans, the bread had nothing but sticks in it, and the soup was terrible, and kohlrabis and some lousy potatoes is what they gave us.
So you weren't a fan of tree flour?
Not really. Not really at all. But the Red Cross was able to, I would like to say, regularly. And the truth is, they regularly did get the boxes to us, but the Germans kept them from us because they just did. And we found out after the war was over, in the warehouse, there were stacks of Red Cross boxes that they had kept from us. And I don't know how many they kept for themselves because, you know, we had Spam in there, we had cigarettes in there, we had Klim, which is milk spelt backwards, powdered milk.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. And as a matter of fact, I remember an awful lot when you think about it. But, you know, there was enough there to sustain us. But without that, we all started to lose weight, and we did lose weight, and we did have sicknesses. And, you know, they only did what they had to do. Would I say they were an enemy that had full respect? Not particularly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've mentioned a couple times being segregated. We need to take another quick break here, but when we come back, we're going to hear about that, what that meant to you, and what the rest of your captivity was like, then more about what you've been doing since then, because you've been one busy bee. Erwin Stoveroff from Florida, our guest today. We'll be right back with more of his story on Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I don't know if we can cover all the ground we want to in this program today. Erwin Stoveroff has so much to share, and a reminder that you can find out everything you need to know about his organization, which he's going to share more about here soon. VetsHelpingHeroes.org is the website. You can go there, see what he looks like. We've got links to that on our website, KMJNow.com. You can even see a photo of his B-17 Passion Pit being shot down. That ended up with his family after he had become a prisoner of war. We talked about his captivity at Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany, and he got there in late 1944, but by early 1945, word started making its way around the camp that the Jewish prisoners would be separated out. And I can't imagine, Erwin, that the first time you heard that, it was anything close to good news.
I really and truly couldn't believe it. My co-pilot's brother was an adjutant to Colonel Gabreski in one of the other compounds. And, of course, they got the news first. And he got a hold of his younger brother, who was my co-pilot, and told him, you know, get Erwin prepared. We're very concerned. And it was at a, we were standing at a roll call, and then they said, we want all the Jewish prisoners to remain, and nobody moved. Nobody moved. And then when they started it, our commanding officer, Colonel Zemke.
Hub Zemke, the great P-47 ace.
The great guy. And he was a great, great man. And he really and truly laid it out to the German commandant that you would better understand you're going to lose this war. And you do anything to my men, anything at all to my men, and you will become a war criminal, and I personally will come here and be sure that you are shot. I mean, he did it. He just told him. And we had another guy by the name of Colonel Spicer, who really made a tremendous speech, and he was sentenced to death for his speech. But, I mean, I have witnessed and I have lived and I've been in a camp with two of the bravest men I've ever known in my life. Mm. But they did it. They segregated us. We were put in a barracks near the front gate, and every Jewish prisoner that they could find, they put in the same area. And I will tell you, from that moment on, I really and truly was concerned about whether I was going to get home. Up until then, I always felt, I really and truly believed that that the Germans, we knew they were going to lose the war. We knew that when we started, but I had that feeling that I was going to get home. I was absolutely going to get home until I got segregated, and then I had questions, and then it was a mental battle then as to what was going to happen.
Now, did you hear at that point that Hitler had ordered all Jewish prisoners to be killed? Is that something?
That's what we were told.
I can imagine why it changed your perspective on things and made you worry.
I must honestly tell you, it wasn't a comfortable environment because, you know, as Colonel Zemke said, these men are American officers. We know them as American officers, and they are recognized as American officers, and you are making a segregation of these men? We do not believe in that. That is not the way we do things. Well, you know, I was part of an organization. My plane, there was 10 guys in my plane. Two of us were Jewish, and 8 of us weren't. But, we were all together, and anybody that knows and anybody that lived through flying in one of those planes, you were a team. You know, there was in combat, you weren't lieutenant, you weren't sergeant, you were whatever your nickname is. My nickname was Russian, and because of my last name being Stovroff, and after we got shot down, I told everybody, for God's sake, don't call me by my nickname. I said, you know, they hate the Russians more than they hate us. And the beautiful part of the whole ending was I got liberated by the Russians.
Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my next question. And obviously there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of suffering, a lot of agony between that segregation and the couple months that were still to go before you were liberated.
Oh, yeah.
But what did that feel like when you realized they don't have time to kill us? Their time is up, we're free, and for us, the war is over.
Oh, it's, it's something you really and truly, you know, you cannot live in the past, but you cannot forget it. Well, that's what we try to tell everybody, including governments, everybody. But you can't forget the past, and you can't forget the traumatic experience that all of us had, being captured and being put in and losing all your rights and relying on the enemy to feed you or take care of you, whatever it is. And it's we all have post-traumatic stress disorder. And like today with these young men coming back, they are in the numbers of maybe 200,000 to 300,000 of them are going to have PTSD from going to two and three and four parts of combat. But, you know, being captured, being held, being the uncertainty and everything, you can't lose it. You can't let it get you, but you can't lose it. And I'm just very fortunate that I accepted what my problems are, and I have shared them as I do my claim work with the other POWs that I've worked with. My friend Ray Naisley and I worked together in Palm Beach, and we have done over 400 claims of ex-POWs. So I've heard a lot of stories. And again, it makes me feel how lucky I am when I hear some of the other stories.
Well, I'm sure all those people that you've helped feel very blessed for your efforts on their behalf, as do the men and women coming back today and that are helped by Vets Helping Heroes. And again, vetshelpingheroes.org to read more about this. You can also link through that website to all kinds of information about Irwin's background and his history. There are a couple more questions that I want to ask you before we get back into some specifics of the vet dogs. Now, I've seen a picture of you shaking hands with another former POW of a different vintage, Senator John McCain, who had the privilege of giving you a Distinguished Flying Cross a few years late, 55 years late to be exact. Tell us how that developed and what that meant to you.
Well, actually what happened is, you know, you sort of drift apart from your crew after years and years, and then all of a sudden you get to the point where, hey, where are these guys that shared an experience in life that few people have? And so I found out that we were having reunions, 44th Bomb Group, and I decided to start going to the reunions. And at the very first reunion, that one of the discussions we had, somebody said, "What'd you do with your medals?" And I said, "I gave them to my grandson." And he said, "Well, why would you give your DFC to your grandson?" And I said, "Why? I never got it." And fortunately, Colonel Gibson, our commanding officer at that point, was alive and there, and we talked to him, and he said absolutely he knew that our entire crew was given the DFC, and so one thing led to another, and I was advised that I was going to get the medal. And did I want to go to a camp, or John McCain was coming down at a certain date and would be happy to give it to me? So that's how I got the medal from John McCain.
Well-deserved, and I'm glad they took care of it eventually for you. It doesn't sound like you were complaining at all, but I'm sure it was still a special moment. Now, more recently, even, you've been given the French Legion of Honor. How did that come about?
Well, that came about because I was working in the VA hospital, and somebody came to me and said, the French government is looking for guys that were involved both on the ground and in the air that had anything to do with helping the freedom of France. And they said, "Didn't you bomb in France?" And I said, "Yeah, I did. Out of my 35 missions, I think I had 7 or 8 of them were in France, somewhere in that area." And they said, "Well, they'd like to send you a form, and they'll analyze your form." And I said, "Well, that will be wonderful." So they sent me the form. And 2 years later, I was advised that the French consulate had said we will be holding a ceremony, and it was a great honor to give you the highest medal that we have, which is the French Legion of Honor. And I have this beautiful medal at home, and it really is really special. And they also told me that please come to France and wear your medal because people will love you. Well, I don't know if I'm going to get to France, and I have yet to wear the medal, but I'm really proud of it. But not as proud of my American medals.
Well, and if you keep telling the ladies that you're 85 and not 87 like you really are, maybe one of them's going to want you to take her to France. So you might have that privilege.
Then I'll give her the medal.
Well, all kidding aside, Irwin, I know that you're not here to talk about all your medals or about what you did, that you're here to spread the word about your organization. But I just want to thank you for serving our country in World War II, for all the service you've provided to veterans since then. And I'm curious if you ever stop and think how things would be different if, A, they'd hit you when they were shooting at you as you parachuted out of that flaming B-17, or if your old neighbor from Buffalo hadn't been the guy to interrogate you in Frankfurt.
Yeah, there are so many things. I know I'm what a fortunate man I am, and I must tell you that doing what I'm doing now is so important, because being part of the American Vet Dog Veterans Canine Corps and being a fundraising arm for them, which we call Vets Helping Heroes, hard to describe how important this thing is, because I know how lucky I am, and I know when I see these young fellas how unfortunate it is for them that for the rest of their life they're going to be disabled one way or another, whether they're blind or whatever it is. And fortunately, we're part of a program that can deliver guide dogs, service dogs, combat stress relief dogs, military therapy dogs. We can cover everything that they need, and that's why I'm so pleased that I am part of it. The American Vet Dog Program is outstanding, and I'm privileged that I can raise the funds that they need so we can take care of these young men coming home.
Yeah, there's no question that you wouldn't still be doing this after you've already raised more than $1.5 million. You wouldn't still be doing this if you didn't really believe that it's making a big difference. I know you just mentioned some of the different areas that those dogs can be employed with the servicemen. Is there anything that people listening today, other than sending you a check in the mail, and they can do that online at the website, but anything other than that that they can do to help this effort?
Well, I wish I could start branches all over the country, which I unfortunately I don't think I can do. But if there are somebody out there listening to me and thinking, yes, there is something I would do, I'd like to do what you're doing, let me know. Or contact the American Vet Dog Program in Smithtown, New York. I'm sure that they would like to have more help, but I'd love to be having branches in every city that I could, but I know that's impossible. But contact me if you want to know who they are and who to talk to, and maybe they are. I don't know if they need any more. Of course, they need more help. But I think there's organizations out in California that are doing the same thing, but not quite as, I believe, as sophisticated as we are, because we're the one organization that does put therapy dogs in Walter Reed for the veterans there to get acclimated to them, and what a therapy dog can do in calming him down in many cases.
I know that you've been bombarded with people wanting to hear from you or wanting to send you checks. I know
yep.
You got a few checks in the mail today. I know that never gets old for you. But if there's one thing that's been shared with you by one of the veterans helped by one of these dogs that you like to share, is there one comment that just makes you feel, you know what, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing? I'm throwing some tough ones at you, I know.
Yeah, I give you an example of just recently I was in Washington and we were having a graduation ceremony, and one of the veterans there has seizures. And while he was there, his dog started to bark, and these dogs do not bark. And it was telling him, sit down, you're going to have a seizure.
Wow.
And we saw it. And we saw how long it took. And then we saw the dog come over and lick his face and wake him up. And, you know, these are so unbelievable things to see what the dog can do. And this is just one example of it. And his name is Mike. And we talked to one another afterwards. And he gave me a big hug. And he said, you know what my dog means to me now. You've seen it. Now, what more can I tell you?
That's a life-saving dog.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing what you're doing. Well, that is perfect, Irwin. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I know your time is very valuable, and I hope that a lot of our listeners are going to be contacting you and supporting this program. And don't stop. I might call you down the road for an update.
Oh, and thank you. Thank you for calling on me.
The least that we can do. Erwin Stoveroff's been our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.